Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. European and U.S. stock markets dropped Monday after Greek voters overwhelmingly rejected austerity demands by international creditors, but stocks in Asia were mixed the day after the Greek vote left open the possibility Greece could exit Europe's 19-nation euro currency bloc. Stocks on major U.S. exchanges are mostly down less than half a percentage point in early trading. Markets dropped more than 1% in Paris and Frankfurt in afternoon trading, with London down less than a percentage point. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei lost more than 2% at the close, while Hong Kong's Hang Seng dropped more than 3%. South Korea's Kospi was also down, along with markets in Sydney and Wellington. Greek finance ministers Yanis Varoufakis resigned Monday, a day after Greek voters overwhelmingly rejected a demand by the country's lenders to impose more austerity measures on the country in exchange for new bailout loans for the government in Athens. His resignation was a surprise because he had said he would only resign if his countrymen voted in favor of accepting the austerity demands. However, Varoufakis said Monday he was made aware of a certain preference by some members of the Eurozone for his absence from meetings of finance ministers. He said his withdrawal from such meetings was an idea the prime minister judged to be potentially helpful to him in reaching an agreement with Greece's creditors. Varoufakis has often clashed with the creditors in the past few months. Again, that's Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis resigned Monday. This is VOA News. Turkey's financial markets are among the worst hit in the face of its Greek neighbors' troubles. The impact is seen as a sign of growing vulnerability in the Turkish economy, which is already under pressure from rising border concerns with Syria and efforts to form a coalition government. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish financial markets have been hit hard by the economic crisis in Greece, and the Turkish lira has hit record lows. The fear of growing financial problems is compounded by the fight against Islamic State and instability in neighbouring Syria. Visiting scholar Sinan Ulugen of the Brussels-based Carnegie Institute says Sunday's referendum in Greece is adding to financial pressure on Turkey.
There are certainly substantive risks for Turkey, given that both the security situation in the region, but also the vote this weekend in Greece, means that there is going to be a degree of turbulence.
The vulnerability of Turkish financial markets to its neighbours' woes is being seen as a sign of underlying economic weakness. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The foreign ministers from the group of six world powers and Iran are locked in intense negotiations in Vienna on Monday, with key disputes still unresolved, a day before the self-imposed July 7th deadline to reach a comprehensive deal to limit Tehran's nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. The diplomats, including U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, stressed that despite some progress, the two sides must still negotiate major differences on key issues. U.S. President Barack Obama makes a rare visit to the Pentagon Monday to confer with national security advisors about refining their strategy to defeat Islamic State militants wreaking havoc in Iraq and Syria. Obama, who has conceded the U.S. lacks a complete strategy, is scheduled to meet with Defense Secretary Ash Carter at 2:20 p.m. Officials in Nigeria said Monday that bombings at a mosque and restaurant in the central city of Jos had killed at least 44 people. The blasts, which happened late Sunday, also wounded at least 47 others. According to the National Emergency Management Agency, the attacks continue a deadly string of violence blamed on Boko Haram militants that has left more than 200 people dead in the past week. Thousands of worshippers camped out overnight in Ecuador awaiting Pope Francis's visit there. He begins a three-country tour with an open-air service in the southwestern city of Guayaquil. More than a million people are expected for the papal mass, which will be taking place on Monday. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In the past week, Boko Haram has slaughtered men in villages and bombed churches and mosques across Nigeria's north, despite the new president's promises to stem the six-year-old insurgency.
That's Chris Stein reporting on whether Nigerians are losing patience with President Muhammadu Buhari. Details coming up.
Also, officials in Nigeria say today that bombings at a mosque and a restaurant in the central city of Jos has killed at least 44 people.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Gabon, and our daily feature. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, officials in Nigeria say 44 were killed and 47 were wounded late last night in attacks on a mosque and a restaurant in Jos, a major city in central Nigeria. Al-Hassan Mohammed of the National Emergency Management Agency says 23 people died in the suicide bombing at Shagalinku, a restaurant popular with state governors and Nigeria's Muslim elite. Another 21 died when armed men gunmen fired into crowds and threw hand grenades at the Yantanya Mosque, where a prominent imam was preaching peaceful coexistence among religions. Earlier on Sunday, a suicide bomber walked into a church in Patipsgum, the largest city in Yobe State, and killed at least five people. That explosion followed a suicide attack Friday near Maiduguri, where officials said six women set off blasts that killed dozens of people. Boko Haram has not claimed responsibility for the recent attacks. However, they are usually blamed for most of the violence. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby condemned the Boko Haram attacks and pledged support for the Nigerian people in their struggle against violent extremism.
Recent defectors from the Lord's Resistance Army say leader Joseph Kony is suffering from diabetes. A researcher from the U.S.-based Enough Project told the Associated Press that combatants surrendering to Ugandan troops last month claimed the fugitive Kony is too sick to fight. They say he's hiding in a Sudanese border region near Central African Republic. Lieutenant Colonel Paddy Anakunda of the Ugandan military verified the reports from Kony deserters. The LRA formed as a tribal uprising against the Ugandan government in the 1980s. The group became notorious for kidnapping children as fighters and forcing girls to be sex slaves. The group is reportedly in decline, with many of its fighters surrendering or dying in firefights with African troops across Central Africa.
In the past week, Boko Haram has slaughtered men in villages and bombed churches and mosques across Nigeria's north, despite the new president's promises to stem the six-year-old insurgency. Chris Stein reports on whether Nigerians are losing patience with President Muhammadu Buhari.
As a candidate, Muhammadu Buhari campaigned on ending the Boko Haram insurgency. But in the months since he entered office, the group's violence has shown no sign of abating. The past week of violence saw the group lay siege to a village outside the Borno state capital, Maiduguri, kill more than 145 people in villages elsewhere in the state, and blow up worshippers at a church in the town of Patiskum in neighboring Yobe state. Bashir Abdullahi is a resident of the north-central city of Jos, where suspected Boko Haram bombers targeted a mosque and restaurant Sunday, killing at least 44 people. Abdullahi says he is satisfied with President Buhari's measures against the group. Mr. Buhari set high expectations for how he would handle the group. Before the March presidential vote, his All Progressives Congress Party put up billboards around the country that read, "We will defeat Boko Haram." If President Buhari does not do that, University of Abuja lecturer Abubakar Kerry says he risks losing credibility with Nigerians.
Most Nigerians expected something drastic, something dramatic, something concrete on the ground. They didn't expect this spate of bombings across the country. They feel that, okay, by now, Boko Haram to truly be a thing of the past. They don't seem to be impressed by the handling of the situation so far.
The spokesman for President Buhari, Femi Adesina, says the president is working on a plan to tackle Boko Haram that will involve troops from neighboring countries.
The framework, the machinery, is being set in motion for a final onslaught against Boko Haram, and it will happen.
President Buhari has called for help from abroad, and he may be getting it. The president will visit the White House later this month, and the United States' Deputy Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, is visiting Nigeria and Niger this week. Boko Haram is expected to be on the agenda of both visits. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
The DRC Minister of Health, Felix Kabangi, says six hunters suspected of contracting the Ebola virus have tested negative. The government and the World Health Organization tested the hunters who exhibited symptoms of the disease after sharing an antelope that appeared sick. Four of the hunters died, but Kabangi says blood samples from all six suspects are negative for Ebola. Last year, a three-month outbreak in the remote forests of northwest Congo killed 49. The virus found in Congo is not related to the West African epidemic that has killed more than 11,000 people in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea in the worst Ebola epidemic on record.
Also, Yahias, the UN Secretary General's International Ebola Recovery Conference is scheduled for July 9th and 10th. Donors will decide how to help Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, whose healthcare systems were decimated by the Ebola epidemic. Today, the World Health Organization outlined its agenda, saying the world is still unprepared for emerging infectious diseases. In a teleconference, WHO Assistant Director General Dr. Marie Pauley Kinney spoke about the importance of getting to zero in new cases.
Well, as you all know, getting to zero is not an easy task. There are locations in Guinea and Sierra Leone where the disease is holding out. And just last week, we discovered a new Ebola death in Liberia, weeks after the country was declared free of Ebola transmission. But getting to zero is not a separate issue from recovery. While foreign teams are still present in the countries, we need to harness the strength and capacity to reboot essential services so that children and pregnant women, as well as people suffering from malaria, diarrhea, and other common conditions, can get the care they need.
Kinney says getting to zero new cases and rebooting health systems are the immediate goals. Building resilient healthcare systems is the longer-term goal.
To do that, WHO will support Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone to build health systems that are resilient to crisis, people-centered, offer safe and quality services that are affordable and available to all, and function in a transparent and accountable way. The work starts with Ebola-affected countries, but goes beyond them. Indeed, resilient health systems are needed in all countries, all of them, in order to address severe epidemics and other global health threats, while also promoting equity and universal health coverage. There are at least 28 other countries whose health systems are as weak as the systems of the three countries before Ebola.
She says no country is immune from disease outbreaks, regardless of where the outbreak begins. She says recovery in West Africa is impossible without dramatically increasing the amount of money spent on health.
So to rebuild the health systems and provide services from now through the end of December 2017, so in a little bit more than 2 years, Guinea has budgeted $1.176 billion and still needs to raise $386.5 million. Liberia has budgeted $550 million and still needs to raise $169.7 million. And finally, Sierra Leone budgeted $361 million and still needs to raise $140 million.
Also addressing the teleconference was WHO Regional Director for Africa, Dr. Matsidiso Moeti. She says the health systems in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone were already struggling to handle routine care and collapsed under Ebola.
In Liberia and Sierra Leone, there was only one doctor for every 30,000 people. In Liberia, there was only one hospital for every 110,000 people. Infection prevention and control practices that are supposed to protect healthcare workers as well as patients were minimal, and ambulances were and are still scarce. Routine outbreak surveillance was not adequate in the three countries, and the rate of maternal and child deaths as well as communicable diseases were high.
Also addressing the WHO teleconference on Ebola was Dr. Philip Ireland, an Ebola survivor who works at the John F. Kennedy Hospital in Monrovia. He said you cannot talk about health unless you talk about malaria. He says during the rainy season, malaria accounts for 40% of the patients seen at Liberian health centers.
Researchers estimated last year almost 11,000 more people died from malaria in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea because of the Ebola epidemic, because the Ebola epidemic collapsed the health systems. The initial symptoms of malaria can be confused with the initial symptoms of Ebola. This is what happened in my case. Better diagnostics, better facilities, more healthcare workers with better pay. All that you've heard could have made a difference against Ebola. I was very fortunate. When I first contracted Ebola, I had a high fever and severe headaches. I went to the nearby Ebola treatment unit, but was turned away. They looked at me, and even as the outbreak was taking off, even though my exposure to the virus made me more likely to contract the virus, they thought I had malaria and sent me home.
Dr. Ireland says building resilient health systems means investing in people, not just infrastructure. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Officials in Nigeria said today that bombings at a mosque and restaurant in the central city of Jos had killed at least 44 people. And recent defectors from the Lord's Resistance Army say leader Joseph Kony is suffering from diabetes. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The World Health Organization reports cholera vaccines are effectively controlling the spread of the deadly disease in a number of high-risk areas around the globe. But WHO says the lack of vaccines limits the ability to protect all in need. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports every year there are an estimated 3 to 5 million cases of cholera and up to 120,000 deaths from the disease. This virulent illness, which can kill in a matter of hours, is caused by ingestion of contaminated food or water. It thrives in unsanitary conditions. An oral cholera vaccine has been around since 1991, but has been given mainly to travelers. This picture has changed for the better in the past couple of years. With funding from international agencies, the WHO has been able to dip into a stockpile of 2 million doses of the vaccine for use in high-risk places. WHO cholera expert Dominique Legault says the vaccine is proving to be an efficient tool to effectively control cholera outbreaks. Legault says he expects increased production of the vaccine in the coming years, with 3 million doses available for use in endemic hotspots and emergency situations.
Of course, this is not the long-term solution for cholera, the long-term solution for cholera. We know it since 150 years. It is development, it is access to safe water, access to sanitation. But really, it works as a sort of key to the door. It shows that something can be done, that impact can be achieved very quickly with the vaccine, and then we can take a follow-up with water and sanitation intervention.
Cholera can occur at any time during the year. The World Health Organization reports about 40 million people in Africa are at risk of the disease. Main hotspots include the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Burundi and Tanzania, South Sudan, Mozambique, and fishing communities in Ghana. Another main focus is around Lake Chad, comprising unstable areas of Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria. Le Gros tells VOA aid workers are vaccinating people against cholera in South Sudan, in Bantu, in Unity State, and in North Juba, the capital. He says plans to vaccinate in Malakal in Upper Nile State had to be abandoned because of insecurity.
We make sure that we allocate the vaccine according to the risk, where the risk is the highest and where the capacity to implement the campaign is also possible. If you send vaccines and then the campaign cannot be performed because of security issues, for example, it's not good, it's not a very good idea.
As of July 4th, the World Health Organization has reports of 632 cholera cases, including 30 deaths from 75 villages in Juba County. It says more than 17,800 cases of cholera, including 150 deaths, have occurred this year in Tanzania. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A trade mission including two leading U.S. officials with the Obama administration has just returned from Africa. The trip to Mozambique, South Africa, and Kenya include representatives from U.S. companies looking to invest on the continent. From Washington, VOA's Peter Clotie has this report written by William Eagle.
Sub-Saharan Africa is home to six of the world's fastest-growing economies, and the continent itself is growing at over 4% per year. The U.S. government sees that as an opportunity for American companies to find trade partners that will create economic benefits and jobs. Representatives from 14 American companies got their chance in late June when they went to meet potential partners in three countries, Mozambique, South Africa, and Kenya. The companies chosen for the trip, including General Electric and Honeywell International, offer world-class products and services in three growing sectors of African economies, transportation, energy, and agricultural equipment. Leading the trade mission were two prominent members of the Obama administration, Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox and Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Global Market Arun Kumar. The trip was part of the Obama administration's campaign to promote U.S. exports, an investment called Doing Business in Africa. It offers U.S. companies opportunities to expand their reach in the global marketplace with African partners. Kumar says many American firms are not familiar with exporting beyond the Western Hemisphere.
This is one of the missions of the Commerce Department, to promote a sense of global awareness, to create the capability of global fluency, to get more and more U.S. companies to export beyond their borders. We often find that there are a large number of U.S. companies that export to just one country, and that might be Canada or Mexico. But what we do find is that once they taste export success, we look beyond those borders and export to many more countries.
In a press meeting with African journalists, Kumar offered his views on the growing economic ties between the United States and Africa. He says that bilateral trade is essential for bringing new investment and technologies to Africa and creating jobs.
For instance, here in South Africa, where I'm speaking from, there are 600 U.S. companies that have created 150,000 jobs. And those 600 companies, the output of those companies account for about 10% of the GDP of South Africa. So that's a clear example of U.S. companies creating jobs. That's a clear example of how, as trade and investment grows, more jobs will be created. And these jobs are typically of a very high quality.
He says that's equally true of African companies like the South African energy and chemicals company Sasol, which invests in the United States.
Sasol is the biggest foreign direct investor in the state of Louisiana. And what is really interesting is that a number of companies from a number of countries both in the developed and developing worlds, are now investing in the United States, because they find that investing in the United States, A, gives them a really good return, because the United States has a very good kind of business climate and a great market.
The U.S. Commerce Department official says many jobs, both in the U.S. and in Africa, rely on the ability to plug into global supply chains where many countries contribute various components to a finished product.
It is very difficult to build an entire product in one country and be competitive. It is very possible to build a component of a product and supply that globally and be competitive. So we encourage the integration of supply chains, and in particular, we're interested in integrating into those supply chains, small and medium enterprises. Because certainly in the United States, the small and medium enterprises are a very innovative and important section of our economy. And we're very focused in seeing how they can plug into global supply chains. And we believe that is an approach that will work well for other countries as well.
Kumar also said African governments can take action to promote investment and promote entrepreneurship. For example, they can provide businesses with clear rules for accessing capital and financing. The state can also encourage an education system that promotes innovation and encourage programs and services that help new companies.
And underpinning all of innovation is having strong IP laws, because a lot of innovation is based on the creation of novel intellectual property, and without strong protection for intellectual property, it would be difficult to create an atmosphere where entrepreneurs can feel safe to prosper.
Kumar says the U.S. also supports other efforts to boost African economies, like greater economic integration among the continent's regions and improved infrastructure. That includes airports and other forms of transportation, as well as harmonized border and customs procedures. In 2014, U.S. exports to sub-Saharan Africa reached a record $25.4 billion, an increase of over 5%. The U.S. government is working to improve on that number. In late July 24 to 26, President Obama will attend the 6th Global Entrepreneurial Summit in Nairobi, Kenya. It will bring together business leaders, mentors, and high-level government officials in an effort to show the U.S. government's support for innovation and economic development around the world. Last November, the Commerce Department introduced a number of small and medium enterprises to opportunities in Africa at a conference called Discover Global Markets. In September, a U.S. government program called Trade Winds will sponsor a business development conference in Johannesburg and a trade mission that will bring 70 U.S. companies to 8 countries in Africa. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked, VOA Africa, don't miss.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of The Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee.
The This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Officials in Nigeria say today that bombings at a mosque and a restaurant in the central city of Jos have killed at least 44 people. And recent defectors from the Lord's Resistance Army say leader Joseph Kony is suffering from diabetes. Coming up, we'll have music from Gabon. And in our feature segment, Harare, hard hit by the recession, is stumbling dangerously into poverty. I'm Kim Lewis with Nehaeus Wuheed, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for U.S. women's soccer.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the U.S. women's national soccer team, which won a record third World Cup title Sunday with a 5-2 victory over defending champion Japan in Vancouver, Canada. The Americans exploded for four goals during the first 16 minutes of the game. USA captain Carly Lloyd was the player of the match and the player of the tournament. She received the Golden Ball Award given to the best player at the Women's World Cup. After some hat-trick heroics in Vancouver, Carly scored three goals in the first half, finding the net in the third, fifth, and 16th minutes. Lloyd's third goal was my favorite. She dodged a challenge near the center circle, and near midfield, she noticed Japan's goalkeeper, Ayumi Kaori, was at the top of the penalty box. Lloyd launched a wonder strike as Kaori backpedaled, stumbled, and got a hand on it before watching the spectacular shot touch the post and roll into the net. Hey, Carly, how does it feel to be a World Cup champion?
I don't think it's entirely sunk in. I'm so proud and so zapped at the same time. It's a surreal moment. It's been amazing. I mean, we just wrote history today and brought this World Cup trophy home, which is unbelievable. But at the end of the day, you know, I think that I've pushed on my status a little bit and I have to stay up here. So it's not right away, but I'll be back to work and back stronger than ever.
As Carly Lloyd said, the USA wrote history with its third Women's World Cup title. The Americans also won the trophy in 1991 and 1999. They also gained a measure of revenge after losing to the Japanese on penalty kicks in the 2011 final. At the post-match news conference, U.S. coach Jill Ellis praised their Asian opponent.
First, I want to congratulate Japan. They are a tremendous opponent and deserving of always ending up in championship matches. Love how they play.
USA coach Jill Ellis talked with Abby Wambach, one of the greatest female soccer players ever, about taking on a different role at this World Cup. The 35-year-old Wambach came off the bench as a second-half substitute in both the semifinals and final. In the end, Wambach celebrated her first World Cup title.
I'm so happy. I'm emotionally exhausted, physically exhausted. I love my teammates. Carly Lloyd, are you kidding me with the effort that she gave tonight? But really, it was a true team effort. Not only just the 23 players, but our staff. It just shows how important every little detail has become.
And speaking of details, let's give a few details now on the award winners at this seventh Women's World Cup in Canada. Carly Lloyd, as I mentioned, won the Golden Ball Award as the best player in the month-long tournament. Lloyd also tied with Germany's Celia Sasic as the top scorer at the Women's World Cup. Each had six goals. Sasic, though, was awarded the Golden Boot based on playing fewer minutes than Lloyd. The Golden Glove Award for top goalkeeper went to American Hope Solo. 19-year-old defender Kadisha Buchanan of Host Canada won the Young Player Award, and the FIFA Fair Play Trophy went to France. In the third-place match at the Women's World Cup, England defeated Germany 1-0 in extra time in Edmonton, Canada. Farrah Williams scored on a penalty kick in the 108th minute for the three Lionesses of England, who had their best ever Women's World Cup showing. Our friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi, joins us now with reaction to the Nigerian Football Federation firing head coach Stephen Keshi.
Good evening, Africa. Nigeria has fired Stephen Keshi as head coach of the country's national team, the Super Eagles. The Nigeria Football Federation, NFF, announced Keshi's sack. The NFF said Keshi lacked the required commitment to achieve the federation's objectives as set out in the coach's contract. The federation had set up a committee to investigate Keshi after it emerged that he applied to coach the national team of Ivory Coast. The coach denies applying for the job, even though his name was among those seeking to coach the Elephants, as the Ivorian national team is known. In the interim, former Super Eagles coach Shaibu Amadu will take charge of the Super Eagles. Keshi led Nigeria to win the Africa Cup of Nations in 2013 in South Africa. He also qualified the Super Eagles for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, where the team was eliminated in the second round. The NFF said it will name a substantive replacement for Keshi in due course. I spoke with two Nigerian sports analysts, Vincent Tubi and Tony Nezian, on the sack of Keshi. First is Vincent Tubi.
I think he deserves it because of the divided loyalty. He was, he's been trying to join either Cote d'Ivoire or one of these West African countries. So he's not been concentrating on his job.
Next is Tony Nezia.
The man now played into the hands of the people who did not want him, and perhaps may have applied, or maybe somebody else applied on his behalf to take over the job in that kind of position of the chief coach of the Elephants of Cote d'Ivoire.
I also asked the two sports analysts whether they think Nigeria should hire a foreign or Nigerian coach to replace Keshi. Here again is Vincent Tubi.
I think the list of local coaches, is now exhausted because I think the problem with our local coaches is that of training. They have to be trained and trained and retrained to catch up with foreign coaches. And on the scale of balance, I think we have done better with foreign coaches than local coaches.
Again, Tony Nezia.
I believe that if they have to be decisive, they should try as much as possible to take that decision quickly.
You've been listening to Nigerian sports analyst Vincent Tubi and Tony Nezia commenting on the sack of Nigeria's head coach, Stephen Keshi. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun. Joining us now with a Monday Wimbledon tennis update is VOA's Jonah Haskell. Sporty greetings, Jonah.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Sister would battle sister for a quarterfinal spot at Wimbledon Monday as Serena Williams took on her older sister Venus in the round of 16. With 10 Wimbledon titles between them, the Williams sisters were sure to put on a good show, and in the end, it was Serena's day. The top-ranked tennis player in the world defeated Venus 6-4, 6-3 to move on to the quarterfinals. Serena, who won the Australian Open and the French Open earlier this year, is seeking her sixth Wimbledon title and a chance to win a calendar year Grand Slam this season. Americans Madison Keys and Coco Vandeweghe also won their round of 16 matches to advance, with the unseeded Vandeweghe upsetting 2015 French Open finalist Lucy Safarova in straight sets. Former Wimbledon champ Maria Sharapova of Russia also moved on, defeating Zarina Diaz of Kazakhstan 6-4, 6-4. And Caroline Wozniacki, who is ranked fifth in the world, lost in straight sets to Garbine Muguruza. Wozniacki, a former world number one, has never made it past the round of 16 at Wimbledon. In the men's bracket, only three players have advanced to the quarterfinals so far. Frenchman Richard Gasquet beat Nick Kyrgios to move on, while unseeded Vasek Pospisil upset Victor Troicki. Also, Stan Wawrinka of the Netherlands just recently won, defeating David Goff of Belgium 6-7, 6-7, and 6-4. The big names in the men's game will be in action later Monday, as Roger Federer will take on Roberto Bautista Agut, while Novak Djokovic faces Kevin Anderson. Anderson, who is from Johannesburg, South Africa, has never reached the quarterfinals of a major tournament before. Last year at Wimbledon, he lost to Andy Murray in the round of 16. And that's our Monday Wimbledon tennis update. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Jonah. The United States is celebrating its third Women's World Cup football title. For reaction, I'm joined by VOA's Tati Abedje. Sporty greetings, Tati.
Sporty greetings, Sonny.
Tati, what did you think of that final in Vancouver?
It was a great final that the USA won their third World Cup. They're the first team in World Cup history to win three World Cups in the Women's World Cup. And it's great that they got their revenge on Japan.
It seems like Carly Lloyd, you mentioned her as sort of the engine of that USA team. She does it again in the final.
She did it again. She's the first player in World Cup final history to record a hat trick, which means that she scored three goals, especially one of her goals scoring from midfield.
Tati, do you feel like the American women have reestablished their dominance of women's football in the wake of that victory?
At least for 1 year. Can they do it for the next couple World Cups? Well, it remains to be seen.
And on that note, it seems like the field is narrowing the gap when it comes to women's football, that some of these unheralded teams are really starting to make inroads.
Yeah, it is. It is. But the U.S. Came out on top because they had the best defense in the tournament.
Hope Solo.
Hope Solo was the best goalie of the tournament. And then the best player of the tournament was Carly Lloyd.
And who were some of the other key players, in your opinion, for the American women, Tati, in addition?
The other key players, well, although Abby Wambach didn't play that much, but she gave them moral support.
And what's next? I mean, will it be the Olympics now? I guess the U.S. will look towards Rio.
Next year's Olympics, 2016. Most of the team could be playing in the Olympics. Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure about Abby Wambach. This probably is her last World Cup.
Yeah, I think maybe Abby might hang up her boots after this one. I mean, what a way to go out.
Great way to go out her career. But it would be nice if she scored a goal in the final. it would be way too good to be true.
And it seems like the U.S. has sort of an affinity for playing the Japanese. They lost to them in the 2011 final. Then they beat them at the Olympics. And now they're back again at the World Cup.
Revenge is sweet.
Overall, Tati, what did you think of that tournament in Canada, the month-long tournament?
The tournament was great. It was great. Some people picked Germany to go all the way, but the U.S. defeated them 2-0. And the U.S. went all the way because of their defense and Carly Lloyd.
There we go. A shout-out for Carly Lloyd. A shout-out for Tati Abedje.
Yes.
Thank you, Tati.
Thank you, Sonny.
And thanks to Jonah Haskell for the Wimbledon update. I'm VOA's Sonny Young. And that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the capital of Zimbabwe, Harare, hit hard by the recession and stumbling dangerously into poverty. And next, cost-effective HIV prevention. But first, some music. Here is Oliver Ngoma from Gabon with Kisu.
Murime umwege, okanyo nikuye
Oliver Ngoma from Gabon with Kisu.
Well, in the 1980s, Zimbabwe's capital was affectionately called the Sunshine City because of its cleanliness. Harare was orderly, roads were well-maintained, the streetlights shone brightly, and there was clean running water. But times have changed. Decayed buildings look like a war zone. Children hang around on street corners with nowhere to go. Homeless people tell stories of disease and crime. These pictures reveal real-life scenes from an urban area hard hit by the recession and still stumbling dangerously into poverty. What has gone wrong in Harare? Reporter Blessing Zulu has more.
Until the late 1980s, the government supplied safe drinking water to 85% of Zimbabwe's urban population. But decades of neglect and corruption have left the pipes dry, forcing many people to drink contaminated water. A cholera epidemic in 2008 killed more than 4,000 people and sickened another 100,000 in the country. Though Harare has not been spared from the economic crisis Zimbabwe in general is going through, many residents allege that the political logjam at townhouse has worsened the situation. Local government minister Ignatius Chombo is alleged to have taken sides with town clerk Tendai Mahachi, who is being accused of refusing to work with the opposition MDC mayor Bernard Manyenyeni and his councillors. Yesterday, Manyenyeni shocked fellow councillors and residents by announcing that he was suspending Mahachi indefinitely, accusing him of refusing to furnish council with the salary schedule for the city's top executives. Asked by Studio 7 to elaborate, Manyenyeni said he was not at liberty to do so.
I'm not particularly excited about commenting on this one. I'm sure you bear with me for now.
This is not the first time that Manyenyeni has tried to suspend Mahachi, as he did it last year, and Minister Chombo rescinded the decision. We asked Manyenyeni if he has sought Chombo's approval this time around. Attempts to get a comment from Chombo and Mahachi were futile, as they were said to have been logged in an emergency meeting. But Deputy Mayor Thomas Muzua shot down reports that Manyenyeni has engaged in Lone Ranger tactics in suspending Mahachi without the knowledge of the full council.
Yeah, he was sent by his immediate boss, who is the mayor. Because under our constitution, a person is given, is sent on leave maybe by his immediate boss. So the mayor is the man responsible for sending Mahachi on leave. I think he's the best person to answer on that one.
Groups representing residents, the Harare Residents Trust, or HRT, and the Combined Harare Residents Association, or CRA, both welcomed the decision to suspend Mahachi. Director of the HRT, Precious Shumba, accused Mahachi of stifling development in the city.
The Harare Residents Trust welcomed the suspension of Dr. Mahachi.
Chairman of the Combined Harare Residents Association, Simbarashe Moyo, concurs.
We have been saying that as residents, we need the best man for the job, someone who is not political, because we believe that the town clerk is too political. He takes a lot of orders from outside the confines of townhouse.
Mavuku resident Jocelyn Manyeruke told Studio 7 that residents of Mavuku have gone for years without running water, and they have to resort to other means to get the precious liquid.
Water problem is very serious in Mavuku. It's very, very serious. And the Zesa, water in the Zesa is very serious.
The cash-strapped Harare City Council has also resorted to attaching and auctioning the property of defaulting ratepayers in a bid to recover over $340 million owed in unpaid rents. Goods being attached include fridges, sofas, generators, television sets, microwaves and bicycles, among others. Shumba says the move is insensitive, but Muzua says the city has no choice as it has to provide services to the residents. The daily struggle for survival in an economy with unemployment estimated at close to 90% has created another problem for Harare, as an estimated 20,000 vendors have invaded the central business district, making it an eyesore. Critics say this is a symptom of a collapsing state where political infighting and corruption are keeping people in poverty and misery. Many blame the political bickering at townhouse for the decay of a city once regarded as a model for a post-colonial city in a developing nation. This is Blessing Zulu in Washington, D.C.
An extra year of schooling has been shown to cut the risk of HIV infection by a third. School offers many benefits, but the authors of a new study say education is also cost-effective as HIV prevention alone. VOA Steve Barragona has more.
Despite unprecedented global public health efforts, more than 2 million people are infected with HIV each year, notes Boston University health economist Jacob Bohr.
There's a real question about how to reduce that number and how to get to a place where the epidemic is really on the decline.
That question is especially pressing in Botswana, where nearly a quarter of the population is infected. Many experts believe more educated people are less likely to contract the virus, but it's been hard to prove. In 1996, Botswana made a change in its education system that offered a natural experiment. The government moved grade 10 back to junior secondary school, which previously had ended at grade 9. The researchers wanted to see what impact that extra year of schooling had years later when the students were adults.
The effects are large, and we were surprised by how large they were.
Writing in the journal The Lancet Global Health, the study found the risk of infection fell about 8 percentage points, from 25% to 17%. The effects were even larger for women, nearly 12 percentage points. And it was cost-effective, in roughly the same range as other proven prevention strategies.
I think that this study really provides evidence that we should consider formal schooling, particularly secondary schooling, as part of HIV prevention.
In an accompanying commentary, New York University health economist Karen Greppen said the study provides strong and compelling evidence that education can lower HIV risk. But she added there's more to gain.
The other reason to keep people in education is actually to educate them and provide them with better opportunities later in life as well.
It's not clear exactly how education lowers HIV risk. Better job prospects might be a factor, especially for women. Or the additional schooling may be improving cognitive skills that help people make better decisions. Bohr says upcoming research will address those questions. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell joined U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash, Acting Assistant Secretary of State Judith Garber, and other leaders on June 19th to destroy more than 1 ton of confiscated elephant ivory in New York's Times Square, sending a clear message that the United States will not tolerate wildlife crimes that threaten to wipe out the African elephant and a host of other species around the globe. The crush was conducted in partnership with the state of New York, the Wildlife Conservationist Society, and New York State Senator Brad Hoylman. Secretary Jewell, who serves as co-chair with Secretary of State Kerry and Attorney General Lynch of the President's Task Force on Combating Wildlife Trafficking, joined Director Ash and thousands of onlookers who witnessed an industrial rock crusher generously donated by Powerscreen crush raw and carved ivory tusks and statues. Secretary Jewell said the ivory crush serves as a stark reminder to the rest of the world that the United States will not tolerate wildlife crimes, especially against iconic and endangered animals. The message is loud and clear. This administration will stop the poachers in their tracks, stop the profits, and work with our international partners to protect our global natural heritage. The Times Square ivory crush builds on momentum generated by the Fish and Wildlife Service's initial destruction of 6 tons of contraband ivory in November 2013. Since then, 9 governments have followed suit to destroy ivory. Campaigns to reduce demand for ivory, both domestically and overseas, and to strengthen international laws and enforcement, have further elevated the issue of wildlife trafficking globally. Regardless of their country of origin, we all lose if elephants, rhinos, tigers, and other iconic animals disappear. The only way we will save them is together through a concerted global effort to end the scourge of wildlife trafficking and the devastation it brings to these animals, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash. The United States, he said, underscored its commitment to winning this fight, and we call on all nations to join us by destroying their confiscated ivory stockpiles, enacting and enforcing strong regulations protecting wildlife from illegal trade, and reducing demand.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the political crisis in South Sudan is taking a heavy toll on the nation's citizens. Nearly 2 million people have been displaced due to the fighting between supporters of President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar. Tune in on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.